Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. This week is sponsored by Environments for Humans, our awesome longtime sponsor. They got coming up an online conference called the CSS Summit. So go to cssummit.com. It's their fifth annual one and learn all about that. There's a discount code SHOPTALK for 20% off if you decide to do it, which you should. And Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com/shoptalk. You all know about Squarespace, but if you don't, keep listening. We'll tell you about it later in the show. There's a coupon code for that too, SHOPTALK4. Anyway, for now, let's kick things off.
Hello and welcome to episode 68 of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about sound effects and front-end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Tiffer Coyer.
Hi. That's a funny thing to say, actually, because that was my nickname as a kid. And don't worry, I'm not even worried that it's going to catch on, because it just won't. Nicknames don't stick to me for whatever reason.
I'm trying so hard, Tiffer.
And I was moving. I was here last week, but I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin now. And I unearthed from a box a pen that my great grandfather engraved for me that says Tiffer Coyer on it. Put it on a shelf.
Chris, I think when we last left you, you were being swarmed by police. But it looks like you made it to this week. So. I don't know if that made it on the show last week. Anyway, Chris, who do we have with us today?
We have Ben Schwarz. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how you doing?
that was weirdly phrased, isn't it? Good. Yeah, so, Ben, this is a little bit later show in the day, just because the time zone is drastically. I'm sure you all know that Australia is in the future, right? That's where Ben lives. Mm. You know, both because of the time zone thing and just because he's like a mental giant, basically.
Yeah, that's how it is. It's 8 a.m. in sunny Australia.
And so Ben's basically a freelance web developer. Is that right? You can't work for you. Got your own little business and take on clients and just make the web better every day. Right?
Yeah, being a freelancer or contractor for about 6 years now. I quit my job and decided to do my own thing.
6 years, you're a pro.
Yeah, I guess. I'm kind of sick and tired of it a little bit, but,
I just feel like when you talk to freelancers sometimes and they're like, I don't know. A few people have been doing it for that long.
Yeah. I hate the term freelancer. Cause freelancer, there was a post recently or I don't know, in the last year where it was like people saying, I'm a freelancer. And somebody was like, no, idiot, you're a business and start taking yourself seriously. So anyway, that's just a little aside, but,
I can see that. I don't like the word entrepreneur either. It just means that do stuff or something. I don't know. It's just that one rubs me the wrong way, but I
think entrepreneur means you gamble, but with businesses and people and employees.
And other people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Just sounds like you're trying to be cool or something. Anyway, so Ben's website is germanforblack.com. I don't even know what that means. Is the word Schwarz German for black?
Yeah, Schwarz is German for black. Yeah. Yep.
Good. So it's a blog, and you should all read it and subscribe because there's a bunch of like hot tips and such on there. One of the things that you've done most recently, which we should talk about a little bit because it's really cool, you just called the gallery CSS, and it's at benschwarz.github.io/gallery-css, you don't have to remember all that. There'll be a link in the show notes, but it's just you set out to build a really simple slideshow thing. You click the little dot, the slide changes. Every website in the world has these things, very common need. And it's JavaScript free. So it's a cool thing as it is, right? But what's extra cool about it is that you can go and look at it and it's free and you can download and use it. But it's also, a miniature business for you too, because you sell it too. But if you buy it, you don't get gallery CSS. You can have that for free, but what you get is a screencast of you explaining how it was built and the tools that you use and what it looks like when you, I mean, you live code it right in front of us. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I rebuilt it, for the screencast.
sure. Yeah.
Which was good. I mean, it meant that, you know, I actually reviewed all of the CSS and SAS that I wrote very, very carefully, you know, cause I was trying to teach people. But yeah, I mean, the whole thing kind of came out of, I was building a site, and a lot of the stuff that I build normally is like either a mini site for like a conference or an event or something, or like a big web app or something. Yeah. So, you know, I was kind of like, oh, well, I want to do another gallery thing, like a little slidey thing. Which jQuery plugin should I use? I'm like, oh God, this is hell. So, yeah, I just tried to do my best not to use jQuery or any JavaScript at all. So I, you know, kind of felt kind of ass backwards into, having to learn something.
It is kind of funny though. It's like that. I'm sure. I don't know. It's like a common programmer thing. Like not invented here, right? Like, oh, there's too many of these gallery plugins. I'm gonna build a new gallery plugin.
Yeah, I didn't even realize you were setting me up to say that. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
The classic developer dilemma.
But this one, there is no jQuery in or any JavaScript because you just click stuff and it uses the target selector. So I'm like halfway through the screencast. You could buy this to learn how to write CSS and how this cool feature works using the target selector and stuff. And that's pretty cool. However, why probably listeners to this show, if you're already, you know, familiar with the target selector, how to build stuff like this on yourself, which I'm sure some of this listeners of the show are already able to do, you might want to watch it to just learn about Grunt, because you use Grunt to build it. So that's like right away in the screencast. You're like, listen, we're going to write in SAS and we're going to use Grunt to compile that SAS. And you're not going to assume any knowledge about that at all, really, and walk you through setting up Grunt for this project. Which is great, because I it's one of those things where like I'm aware of, and I could probably go to the Grunt website and like download it and like find some tutorial somewhere and probably figure it out, but I just never have, and now I don't need to because I've watched your screencast and I get it now.
Yeah.
So if you've never done Grunt, buy this. Cool.
Yeah.
I think this sounds like a really great model for open source. Just, I know we, Chris and I have FitVids and we get all these issues like, it's not working, you know, and it's just like a little education. If somebody were to pay for a little education on why and how it works, it seems like that would be really awesome. I don't know. People would benefit. Do you find that that's happening, Ben?
Yeah. I think Chris said at the top, you know, it's like a little business thing. I mean, in terms of money, if I was to put money versus my time for contracting and stuff, I would totally never do that ever again. because, you know, I learned every Adobe software package that's there, doing audio and video and cutting it up and mixing it around and stuff. But I learn a ton by doing that. But, you know, I think there is a lot of value in teaching people that because, you know, like Grunt, I knew people didn't know Grunt that much. And I really feel like people should because people are writing amazing tools for Grunt. So, you know, that was kind of important. And, sorry, I'm a little distracted by the noise out the back there.
Sound just fine.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, you know, and sometimes you kind of go, you kind of forget what you know, if you know what I mean. So even just little things like, you know, the stuff that you use in your editor, the way that you've got your editor set it up, or maybe the fact that you, one of the things in the video that I do, or I think I show it, or anyway, I do it in the open source release, is I actually write all my CSS unprefixed, and then I run it through something to actually do all the prefixes for me. And I just use prefix-free in the browser. And that's kind of a little technique that I've come up with. But as I show it to people, I learn more and more that they don't do that as well. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's cool. And so that's just one of the tools, you know. And then you're using Sublime Text, so you're learning how to use that. And then you use Bower for the package management. So you're like, oh, I need prefix-free. It takes you about 2 seconds to add prefix-p to the project because you just, like, pop open your little plugin thing and do it and bower up it, you know, which is just this thing that like goes and gets it and puts it in your, you know, it's pretty simple in concept. But that's another thing that I didn't know very much about. And I'm like, oh, that is pretty cool. It took you like 2 seconds to go get that, to go get prefix free and just chuck it in the project and link up the script and off you go. Good.
Yep.
Cool stuff. And you're like writing in Emmet, so people can, if they're not familiar with that tool, it's all in it. So the tooling is just as valuable in the screencast. And I just think it's a clever, not that we can move on, but I just think it's such a clever like little business model to do it. And yes, Dave, you should make a video and sell it for Fitbids.
Yeah.
Here's the plugin for free, and for $12 you can get the video too that shows how to install it and just, you know, as an learning experience. Yeah.
That's cool. Hey.
Well, Dave, you should do that.
I'll find the time.
Someday. I'll buy it. Oh, I will buy it. You'll get one sale at least. If
well, then, Ben, you got to sell like a template for built one-off sales videos and sell that.
Yeah, it's actually
how meta is that?
So many people. Well, they're like, oh, you should do a screencast about screencasting.
That's meta.
yeah. I was actually thinking about doing it. I mean, it seems crazy, but like I said, it took me 3 weeks to put that damn thing together, so maybe I could save some other people some time.
I am just Captain Record and see how it goes.
Yeah.
Which is why you make money on screencasting and I don't.
wah, wah, wah.
I kind of do, actually. The gallery. So there's a couple things that today is literally Global Accessibility Awareness Day. Is that right,
yeah.
Dave?
Yeah, I wanted to mention it. You guys probably know I'm involved with the Accessibility Project, and a lot of people listen to the show who are in the chat room do the A11Y Project. But today is Global Accessibility Awareness Day, .org or whatever. And yeah, it's just kind of a chance to kind of take some time today to either empathize or learn about web accessibility. Kind of one of the things, this is actually something I did myself. I turned my mouse off for an hour just to kind of navigate around websites and try to use like social networks and stuff. It was awful. I started drinking like 15 minutes into it. It was terrible. I was like,
you don't need a mouse to drink.
Exactly. It was like, well, my hands busy or free, so I'm just going to start drinking. But yeah, it was, dude, it was quite a learning experience. So, I'm kind of getting there. I don't know. And I know how to use a screen reader and stuff like that. So I was able to like kind of do some workarounds. So like navigate around a page and stuff like that. But dude, to click a link, I mean, I'm going to call somebody out, but like to click a link on Twitter using just your keyboard, it's impossible. Because they stop all the events, like they capture all keyboard events on the search input, which is like the fourth input or whatever, fourth tab in. So like you can't
once
even
you're
get
there,
around.
You can't tap because a tab is a tab.
Yep, you're boned. So anyway,
I wonder how that is in CodePen because I worked on making dang sure a tab was a tab.
Oh. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it's maybe a little bit different there, right? Because, I mean, like, you expect it to be a code editor and stuff like that. But, yeah, it was just interesting. I was just kind of, like, enlightened by that. But, so anyway, Global Accessibility Awareness Day, I wrote an article for Team Treehouse, the Treehouse blog. So that will include a link to that. And you can just kind of, you know, start thinking about accessibility and bringing it into your daily workflow.
Yeah. I like the movement of accessibility towards like just having it be part of the, you know, just how, this in the same way that you think about HTML and CSS and cool JavaScript stuff, you know, like think of accessibility also.
Like yeah, this. I've been thinking a lot about how like the web, like before we touch it, is like perfectly responsive and perfectly accessible, and then
developers get involved.
Yeah, and then we add CSS and JavaScript, and we ruin everything. So anyway, so it's kind of just accessibility is really just cleaning up the mess you made. So anyway, there you go. Mm. Any more links? This one's exciting.
Well, yeah, The Onion is on GitHub now, and it was going all over, which just I just feel like they owe an apology to Dave, basically, because they just are like, oh, we're going to take Dave's idea. And anyway, your idea was fartresize.js, and The Onion came out with fartscroll.js today. So you add this little script to your page, and it just makes little fart sounds as you scroll down. Parallax farting.
Parallax farting. I this is pretty awesome. I don't care if they rip me off or whatever, but
I'm just kidding.
What I am passionate about is farts and JavaScript. I'm passionate about that. So I want to make sure that happens.
Maybe tomorrow can be like National Fart JavaScript Awareness Day.
Every time you fire an alert, it triggers a fart.
Oh, man.
Anyway. It's... I kind of am really excited to see what The Onion puts on their GitHub, going forward. Because there's a lot to parody.
There wasn't even that many followers when I looked earlier. I think this is the people's awareness that's a thing now. Oh, that's funny. So,
anyhow.
I'm trying to get to their... forget it. Okay. Maybe Q&A, huh?
Yeah, let's jump in.
We
got so many. This is the meat and potatoes of the Shop Talk Show, the best part. And the first question is an audio question, and it comes from Becky Ham, and it's just for you, Ben. So here we go. Hold on, loading.
Hey guys, I was watching Ben's Gallery CSS screencast today, and I saw that he was using grunt.js. I was wondering, in what scenarios do you use grunt in your workflow? I use CodeKit right now, and I see it does similar things to grunt, so I just wanted to know when you would use one or the other. Thanks.
Good question. Ben, when do you use grunt, and when do you just stick to CodeKit? Do you have a rule of thumb there?
I don't use any GUI based tools like that. I use grunt pretty much every new project I'm working on now. And sometimes I even port it back to old projects when I get there. I have a history previously in Ruby, been writing Ruby for 6 or 7 years now. And, so like a lot of the projects that I work on are Ruby based, and, SAS is obviously written in Ruby. But I think that kind of tool chain really sucks for front end people. Because it'll be a project that doesn't necessarily have Ruby. And then you're like, oh yeah, you didn't want Ruby. Well, tough luck. Now you've got SAS. And I know that, with grunt and compiling SAS, you still need Ruby in the background. But I think, it just lowers the barrier a little bit. Grunt has, like I said earlier, it has such amazing tools written for it. And, you've got really, really talented people, who are actually able to write, super powerful stuff. So I think I would use grunt pretty much every opportunity I get, really. I don't know. What about you guys?
I do come from kind of a Ruby background as well. So I have like a lot of that. It's just like, I'm just going to Ruby it, but I do use CodeKit because it's easier to get other designers and people, who aren't as command line-y. It's either easier to get them on board with SAS and stuff like that using CodeKit or something like that. So I guess like that's where I see the value in CodeKit, but do you think they should just switch over to grunt? Like, do you think everyone should be command lining, or do you think grunt should get a GUI or something like that? Or is that even possible?
I never thought about giving it a GUI. I guess you could.
Definitely possible. I think grunt needs a GUI for sure. Watching your video and then like the grunt like configuration file, it takes you about 2 minutes to get, 8 levels deep in the little object literal to define everything. I get it. Like the things that you're doing are settings. It's tailor made for some radio boxes, some drop downs, a cool little doc icon where you open it up and point it at the folder and just pick modules from a list. Oh, it's just begging for a UI.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, every project doesn't need to be so custom either. I mean, I kind of do that myself. Like, I use the same grunt file that I used the last time, and then I mess around with it and change it and everything. But, you know, maybe that would be a good way for front-end people to develop some conventions, you know, kind of like how Ruby and Rails are, you know, conventions over configuration. Maybe we could have a similar thing through grunt and, you know, a GUI tool and a package, you know, a bunch of packages that we all use or something.
Here's the crux of it, though, this question for Becky, who wants to know why you might go with one or the other, though. Let's say you're going to go with CodeKit. I like CodeKit because it didn't even just lower the bar a little bit. It lowered the bar, like, all the way down to the floor. And tons of people now use it. It did huge things for SAS and Less and CoffeeScript and everything. It's brought pre-processing to the masses, and it's awesome, along with some of the other ones. But, you know, as we know, we generally use CodeKit. It's the nicest one, I think. But if you have a team, even if you're three guys like Paravel is, everybody's got to buy it, everybody's got to put it on their machine, and then the settings for it are different from machine to machine, so, and that's not part of your repository, you know, so you got to make sure everybody's on the same page with the settings in CodeKit. When you use grunt, that grunt file is in the repo, and all you got to do is like npm install or whatever you do, and then grunt watch, and everybody's on the same page. Everything's going to work exactly the same way across everybody that runs this project. It makes way more sense for like an open source project or something that's on GitHub or something that people have different tooling or whatever.
Yeah.
Isn't that the deal? It keeps everybody on the same page or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's important to be able to check out a project from Git or, you know, whatever source control you use and type one command and then be up to speed with, you know, where everyone else should be. You know, the app should just run all the time, you know, super easily. But so what you're saying, Chris, is like you think the value in grunt or tools like grunt is that it's checked into your project, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know,
yeah,
maybe...
And CodeKit could have a file like that, and they might actually. Yeah, and Compass has like config.rb or whatever, so there's some settings sharing there.
Yeah, that's a particular issue that I don't, you know, that's a particular thing that I really don't like about Compass. It's like, oh, you're writing this superset of CSS, blah, 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 and then suddenly, bam, you're in Ruby, and you don't even know why.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. And then the second that grunt gets a UI, all the same problems that we just described for CodeKit are there again. So everybody's got to buy it, everybody's got to install it, everybody, yeah. But it still would be cool. So just so that people don't get it and have never heard of grunt, they can accomplish the same things. Grunt is technically more powerful, and it can just do anything that your mind can imagine that you might want to run on your project. Grunt can do. And it does feel weird. It's like it's a package. I don't know what they call it, but they say in JavaScript, grunt.js. And it's JavaScript in that it's Node, right? But like Node looks like JavaScript, but it's not really JavaScript, right? It just shares the same syntax as JavaScript, but it's server side code.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know what to say about that, but it's just confusing when you're like, oh, JavaScript can run a CSS preprocessor, like Node can.
Yeah, yeah. But did we answer the question? Kind of forgot what the
so.
Yeah.
It was just like when you use grunt and why would you ever use grunt? And I think we squished it.
Yeah, I don't. It's a funny question because you know, I'm comfortable in the command line, but the thing is, I'm not going to tell everybody, oh, that's what you should be doing. Like that's the way to work. I mean, people produce amazing stuff and they don't use the command line. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I always use it, so that's the tool chain that I go with.
I think it has like if everyone was that convention thing, if everyone like switched over to this or and that's kind of high thinking there, but you know, we could really start leveraging we could really start having real power in building stuff if we're just installing everything off of Bower, we're installing, you know, we're compiling everything. Everyone's kind of using a required JS kind of situation. Code's getting minified. CSS is getting compiled. It would be kind of killer, I guess. Killer if everyone kind of headed that way.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I'm super excited about Bower. I know it's been out for a little while now, but I only really started paying attention to it recently. And it's getting a lot of attention now, I think, as well. So I'm super excited for the future of Bower because I think, you know, I think it's going to make our jobs a lot easier for front end stuff anyway.
Cool.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, let's go on to the next question. Gabe Luthi writes in, I'd love to hear more discussion about UA sniffing and why it's the worst thing ever or not. In the last rapid fire, you guys touched on it a bit, and the tone was generally it's bad and should be avoided. That is true, or that is what we said. To me, it seems philosophically like it's bad, but in practice, it's used quite a bit, and that it works most of the time. Seems to me like while it does fail occasionally, it shouldn't be relied upon for important content decisions. That it is reliable enough to be used responsibly. Okay, while it does fail occasionally and shouldn't be relied upon, it's pretty reliable, is kind of what he's saying. A pretty successful dev colleague of mine swears by this PHP script, Mobile Detect, on GitHub, and we got into discussion about it. He swears it's great, and with proper fallbacks, there's nothing to worry about. What are some of the worst-case scenarios when using something like this? For example, serve less bandwidth, heavy content to mobile devices.
Classic, right?
Yeah. Do you want to summarize it, Chris?
Sure. You know, it's that, can you use UA sniffing responsibly? Can you like go UA sniffing light? Is there anything good you can do with UA sniffing, or is it just all dogmatically bad all the time forever?
UA sniffing the good parts.
Yeah. Is there any redeeming qualities of it or not? And so here's the facts, though. Like, there are tons of site doing it. I think I read somewhere that, like, if you look at the 100 most popular websites on the internet, some like super high percentage of them do some kind of UA sniffing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to get to the opinion that it is dogmatically all the time a bad idea. I'm getting there, because every time I've tried to dabble with it in a little bit, I've been like, gross. It just gets worse all the time. What I would say, how I would intro this, I think, is to say that what you get out of a UA sniffer, even a tool like this one that you linked up, Mobile Detect, and there's a Ruby one and stuff, is you get some like logic that you can then use in your code. You get if mobile device, if tablet. And then it's up to you as a developer to use that Boolean decision to then do something else, right? That's what you get. That's what you want. That's what you're looking for. You want some tool to give you true or false if tablet. The thing is, what are you then going to do with if tablet? After you know if tablet is true, then you're going to make some other choices. You're going to be like, oh, it must be a small screen then, so I'll serve it some little tiny version of our website. Or, oh, it must for sure have touch capabilities then, so I'll do something special for that. You're going to make some further assumptions that are probably going to bite you, is the problem.
Mm.
That's where the crux of UA sniffing sucks at, I think. Because if you just, like, if tablet, what the heck is that? Is it if 7-inch tablet? If 11-inch tablet, if crazy 30-inch tablet thing, you know, like, how do you know what the UA for like some super huge tablet coming out is going to be? You're probably going to get it wrong, and then you're going to assume small screen version, even though it's a huge screen or whatever. Even the 7 to 11-inch tablet thing that's the one that bit me most recently, that I was like, oh, this is terrible. I have to stop doing this. What you want to be basing these decisions on is if the screen is big or not, or, you know, or if it has touch devices, which that's a bad example because it's a really super hard to detect that. You want to make you want to make these choices based on real data, not just like, oh, I know what the user agent is, so I know the screen size and the capabilities and all that stuff. How did I do?
That's good. That's a good summation. Ben, do you UA sniff? Are you going to admit this here live on the show?
No, I would never admit that. But you guys are saying like, so UA sniffing is always bad. There are situations where, I mean, you know, the way that, like, the best practice way that people will tell you to do it is to like detect a feature, or like use a JavaScript method, like query selector all, and then you know if you need like a, you know, jQuery or something to select DOM elements. But, you know, I use Modernizer for a bunch of stuff, and Modernizer is really rad. And, you know, Sometimes you want to know if there is touch support. But Modernizer this week in their issues, issue 880 on Modernizer, I was just looking at it, they've got touch classes being added on Windows 8 on a regular PC that doesn't have touch support. And, you know, even the Modernizer people are finding it really impossible to find out which way to detect which device, you know, is actually, you know, touch capable. And, you know, I've used that Modernizer feature before. So by that right, does that mean that I'm essentially doing the same thing? You know, that's just as bad as doing UA sniffing, right?
No, because it's, so what you're saying is their detection isn't reliable for that particular thing, and so you're making a choice based on bad data or what?
Yeah, but that's the same thing as UA sniffing, because in UA sniffing you would be like, oh, it's Firefox, well, I guess I'll do it this way, right? Or that's the way that, yeah, you know, some people do it, right. And you cannot rely on that actually being true.
True, but that's a small subset of Modernizer. I mean, most of Modernizer does an actual feature detect that actually detects the feature and actually is 100% accurate, whether it's true or false, right?
Yeah. Modernizer is amazing. But, you know, I think the point still stands that, you know, if you are trying to detect what a device is capable of, sometimes you might be left in the cold. It might not work out for everyone.
Sure.
So even feature detection kind of sucks.
It can do. It can do.
Yeah.
So what you'd really want is Modernizer on the server. And I even have a post about it recently because, yes, that's what I want. I don't want to do if tablet. I want to do if screen is less than 800 pixels. That's what I want to know. So that's not even Modernizer. What I want to is measure the screen, set a cookie, check and test the cookie. And it's more complicated than that because you have to deal with all kinds of weird edge case scenarios. But that's what I want to know server side. So if I'm making the choice, if I'm going to serve a mobile template or not, or even a little piece of a template, for example, someplace in CodePen I have tabs. And there's too many tabs to fit horizontally on a really small screen, so I just want to serve a select instead. It's not a whole different template. It's just a little piece of a template that if I knew for sure it was a small screen, I would serve that little piece instead. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, cookie.
Cookie. you know, the only way I could... Yeah, it's tough. Like, I think if you're trying to determine mobile, tablet, desktop for just by these massive lists of devices like Mobile Detect, and I think Mobile Detect is probably really great. If you're trying to just like go by these to like decipher things, divine what this device is, I think you're going to fail pretty hard because mobile, tablet, desktop is so messed up, especially with Windows 8, you know. Kind of introducing this tablet that also has a keyboard that also, you know, kind of doesn't fit in your pocket and stuff like that. But places where I see it could be useful is like, let's say we started a game company called Shop Talk Games and we make really radical games, and we have one for iOS and Android. You know, maybe we have, I don't know, maybe we have like a download on the Android store button or something like that, that we detected from the UA. But even still, it's like, maybe somebody's visiting there from their Android tablet, wondering if they have an iPhone version, you know. So then you can get busted and you lost a sale.
True. And I don't even know what you would assume that because that was so broad that you could detect that pretty reliably, but I don't even know. I have no idea.
Yeah. I mean, that's where it gets weird. It's kind of like, I feel like if you're going to target, be sure you're pretty good at targeting. So, somebody's mentioning serving high res images in the chat room. Here again, it's like, you got to know the DPI of every single device. That's pretty intense. Mm-hmm. Like,
cookie.
I don't know. Cookie.
Just use a cookie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cookie all the time. 8 terabyte cookies of everything.
Hey, did you guys see the thing by Estelle Wheel that came out recently? The SVG
Weil
image thing.
That's for next time.
What's it called?
Yeah, she puts a... Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. I actually was working with her the very night she was discovering it because she had this super good idea. It's like, oh, I want to figure this out too. And then, you know, I mean, it's 100% her idea. It was cool to be there when she
It's kind of Yodog, right? It's like a PNG inside an SVG inside an object tag.
Mm-hmm.
There's a-
yeah, it's deep. It's deep. And it's not something I would want to write, but it is kind of, it's like a genius idea, really. The point is that SVG's media queries are triggered on the size of themselves, not of the browser window size, like all other media queries are, which is like weird, unprecedented, and I don't, hopefully it's not a bug that they fix or something, because that's how this thing works.
Mm-hmm.
And so then there's like a div in there, and the div has like a background image on it, and then you link up, you know, all the different versions of it, and only you can use actual media queries. And we know that high-res images are not really a problem in CSS, because media queries kind of solves the problem. The problem is we don't really have media queries in like inline content-D images.
Mm-hmm.
So now we can. Although if this uses background image, why can't you just use background image in CSS and skip the SVG step? Oh, because the media queries don't work the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's rad anyway. I think it's a really cool technique. Even if it's not something that you would use now, which I probably wouldn't, but there is so much clever stuff in that little bit of SVG and markup there, yeah, that it's definitely worth reading, at least.
I might, especially if it was like an image gallery or something where you're only writing it once and they're all programmatically generated, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would use it in a scenario like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like it, but I feel like it just highlights why we need a responsive image solution.
Right.
It's just like, are you kidding me? An object inside an SVG inside it, like, I don't know. That's for me, but
and even in there,
I love it though.
Yeah, it's like a four level thing.
Yeah, but you know, I think that you know people like standards bodies, etc. They talk so much about tech that we should be doing, and this is a way that we could be doing it, etc. What Estelle's actually gone and done is worked out a way that we can have something that works in the browser, and whatever the technique is to make it work, you know, leave that aside. But she's actually demonstrated what we could use and how we would use it, and actually gives a use case for it, which I think is actually the really interesting, important part. So we'll learn a lot about that as a technique, and you know, maybe it will work for building sites, and maybe it won't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I just think it's amazing.
Let me do a quick sponsor. We have Squarespace sponsoring us this week, which is awesome. Squarespace is it's a website for building websites, which I'm sure most of you have heard of or whatever. It's really cool. They're always under super heavy active development at Squarespace. It's one of the things that I like about them. You know, it's not like they've just built this thing and they're going to sit on it forever. So they have some new themes that I thought were really cool that I got to look at. One is called Adriandak. So adriandak.demo.squarespace.com, and you can see the thing. I'll show notes, link it up. But it's just it's got like just a little bit of parallax just for kind of the header area. So it's not annoying. You know, I don't mean to say parallax and heavy like instantly like scoff. It's super tastefully done. And there's momentum-demo.squarespace.com, some cool themes. No matter what theme that you pick from Squarespace, all of the Squarespace-y stuff will work on that theme. So they have e-commerce stuff they're doing right now. It'll work on any of these themes. They have a new calendar feature that will work on any of these themes. They look great on mobile devices. You know, they're like super nice-looking websites, which I think this is particularly relevant for the Squarespace audience. It's kind of the like, you know, you get a job request from somebody who you know doesn't need you. You're like too good to build a website for them, basically. But you know what they need is just something really simple, like they're a musician, right? If it's just like some musician down the street that you know that needs a website, I think they're better off using something like Squarespace so that they can manage it themselves. It looks great. It's easy. It gives them the power to do it. And if later on they become, you know, a mega hit, you know, they can think of you to design something custom for them. But not that this isn't custom or whatever. You know what I mean? The back end of Squarespace is really good. It's kind of drag and drop to kind of configure things around, and it's all responsive. All the templates are super nice. And I just thought I'd mention quick is developers.squarespace.com. If you're like a hardcore developer, you can get as hardcore as you want about Squarespace. So for example, if you have a custom theme and you want to activate this feature, your theme on Squarespace is like a little Git repository. So like literally you can use Git to work locally and push this stuff up. And you get automatically, they have Less is the preprocessor they use. The templates that build the pages are all like, it's like it's JSON. You kind of describe it as an object literal or whatever. And that's what kind of builds the pages. It's pretty cool and pretty powerful. And check out developers.squarespace.com to show you all what's up there. You could literally be like a Squarespace shop these days if you want it to be. Anyway, use for a discount. I forget how much it is, but if you're going to use it and you want to save some money, put in the code SHOPTALK4 when it asks you for the code. Save some money.
SHOPTALK4.
SHOPTALK4. Yep.
Awesome. I was going to say I have a friend. He's a industrial contractor, contractor. He builds houses and stuff like that, or remodels kitchens. He needs a portfolio. I don't want to build and maintain his website on something like WordPress. So I'm going to put him up on Squarespace and I'm going to charge him some money, but it's not going to be Square or Paravel bucks or anything like that. But it's going to, you know, it's like, I'm going the easy route. I'm going to take a pretty simple theme and I'm just going to plug his content into it. So there you go. Perfect use case.
Indeed. Mr. Ryan Seddon.
Of
Melbourne / Modernizer
mm-hmm.
asks, is it true that Ben's blood is pure whiskey?
Oh, it is. I asked him to ask an awkward question. That's better than I thought it would be. Actually, that's not too bad. I can deal with that. All right, Ryan, I'll get you back sometime. Don't worry. You guys should have him on next time. Maybe.
Yeah, we should get Ryan on. He's the CSS ninja. He's on the Modernizer team and stuff. Melbourne dude.
Yeah, you know, when I met him, he lived like two blocks away from me, and we'd never come across each other, and it was like, oh, I'm gonna head out home, see you later, and then it was like, oh, you're this way. Oh, okay. So yeah, that was kind of strange, but yeah, he's great. He's great. You should get him on. And I can ask him questions.
We'll do that.
Yeah.
Is Melbourne, is that how you say it? Is that cooler than Sydney in terms of what web stuff that's happening in Australia? Can you give us the beat on web design and development in Australia?
Yeah. So, 10 years ago, I would have said there was so much more happening in Sydney in terms of web stuff. But Melbourne has really kind of exploded in the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. There's a ton of shops down here doing Ruby stuff. I mean, half of the people that I know that do Ruby have moved down to Melbourne. And our community is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's gotten from the point where I used to know everyone. Now I feel like I know no one. So Melbourne's really kicking ass. Sydney's great though. I don't like to say the city's not as good. It's not, but it's not.
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks. I just feel like I hear more about Melbourne than Sydney, just kind of globally. So in terms of web stuff. So thanks.
Yeah.
I think you answered my question.
Yeah. So. You should come out here.
Awesome. I should buy a jet and move there.
Yeah, Shop Talk Show jet. Just get that.
Was it expensive?
Yeah.
Chris?
Done.
We'll need to sell more ladies' t-shirts.
I mean, it's going to be sure. Pedal power, but we
can get there. All right. Should we go on? Next question.
Mm-hmm. Mark Phoenix has an audio question for us.
Here we go.
Hi, chaps. I was wondering when I should be thinking of looking into SAS. I've been learning to code for just under a year. I'm pretty competent with CSS, if a little slow still. Would using SAS be bad for my learning? What level of competence should I be at before I start looking to use SAS? Also, it seems that most of the best tools like CodeKit and Compass and whatnot seem to be Mac only. Do you have any suggestions for a good Windows setup? Thank you, and thanks for doing a great show. Cheers.
Okay, Ben, when should this guy Mark get into SAS? He's been coding for about a year. What do you think?
Hmm, That's interesting. I never thought about SaaS from zero before. I think if you dive in too early, you're going to be distracted by the tools, et cetera. So I would say try and get something like CodeKit. There is something for Windows. I don't know. We can Google around. I can find the one I'm thinking of.
Well, what about Grunt? I mean, you can run Node on a Windows box, right? I mean, would that solve that issue?
You're still going to need Ruby, right? So there you go. There's your thing. You're like, oh, well, now I need Ruby. So now you've got two problems.
So explain that to me for a minute, because I understand that SAS is Ruby and that you need a Ruby compiler or whatever. So if you go and install Grunt like you did in your screencast and you use the little Grunt plugin that's called, I don't even remember what it's called, something SAS and something watch or whatever. Those are the two little packagey things you use. Will it just fail when you run Grunt? Because it'll be like, oh, I don't have Ruby. I need that, dude. Didn't you know that? Or will it go like get it for you and install it?
Yeah, I think it'll fail. I'm pretty sure it will. I haven't done that because obviously I have Ruby and SAS installed. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it'll fail. But you know, getting back to the question, I would only dive into SAS if you feel like you need something to help you move faster, or you want to maybe make your CSS more modular, or you know, anything like that. There's a lot of benefits to running your code through a build system, right? It's not just SAS, it's the other stuff that you get as well, or the other stuff that you start thinking about. So I would maybe wait. If you were just doing CSS for a little bit, I would actually probably go and really spend some time just doing raw CSS. There's nothing wrong with that, right?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And Mark knows that because he's saying he's gone a year now and he's stayed on CSS, and that's fine. I do feel like a good firm's understanding of CSS is smart, but you know, if you've been doing it a year, and he says himself, I'm pretty competent with CSS, I would say that now is the time to probably start looking into pre-processing. So
yeah, well, I mean, how long? I know you, Chris, you didn't use SAS for forever, right?
Yeah, but that's because it was like less cool for a while. I feel late on board still.
But you know, you write lots of CSS and people know you for CSS, and there you go. You took your time too. And you're a badass.
No harm in that.
Yeah.
No harm in that. Although I do feel like the train is rolling on this thing. It's yet to totally shake out. I think that people are going to get into preprocessors early now, earlier than they did back in our day, because the advantages are just so huge. It's just hard to ignore now. That's why I have a recent kind of talk on it, I feel like, because it's just the like I said, the train has left the station on this thing. We need this. We need that level of abstraction now to be efficient.
Yeah.
I was going to say there's two apps, compass.handlino.com, and we can put it's compass.app if you Google it. And then there's also one called Scout. Scout app it's on GitHub, and I've used that one before.
And Live Reload
too. And Live Reload. Yeah. They all do Windows, and I'm not sure if they bundle Ruby or not. I seem to think they do because I think I've installed them on a totally clean machine and gotten it going. So that's your way in. In my brain, I was just thinking about this, like, when did I start using them and why did I start using them? Preprocessors, that is. And I think it's like when you hit this like breaking point of like, if I type one more CSS, like vendor prefix, I will kill somebody. Like if you're at that point, use a,
indeed
start looking into it. But then again, you know, you could use something like prefix free, yeah, but start looking into them at that point. That would be my, when you're totally done with writing a vendor prefix or you'll quit your job. That's good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would never work on a project without a preprocessor for CSS, right? So, you know, that's me, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's becoming the default. I mean, so much to, like every example you're going to see on some blog is written in a preprocessor, probably SAS. And every, you know, like everything we're now like showing, you know, in talks and conferences and stuff like that, like those are all turning into preprocessor code. So I feel that could be
because the web is getting more complicated. What we're able to do on the web is getting more complex and more complex, and then we step up the ladder of abstraction to help with that. It's a perfectly natural thing. It's happened tons of different times in the history of computing, and it will happen again.
Hmm. I think actually one point that we didn't make about SAS or any other preprocessor is that most of them, you can just write CSS without changing your style. Like, you can get an existing CSS file that works and then run it through SAS, right? Like, it's not going to break anything. So as long as you get the tool chain going, you can run it through, and then you can start going, oh, well, maybe I'll try using variables to try and clean up my code a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. The first thing you'll do is probably switch to using some mixins for the CSS3 stuff, because that's the thing that probably got you there in the first place. Then exactly variables for colors, then nest a few things, because that just kind of feels good. And it's a pretty easy walk in.
Yeah.
Good point. Renee Ruiz asks, what workflow should you use for Git if you're not building web apps? Feature branches make sense when you're adding features to a web app, hence, feature branch. But what about when you're just creating like a WordPress site? Should you be using branches or just work off master? Good point, Renee. What's up with that? Like, what gallery.css surely is a Git, well, it is a GitHub project. It's not a web app. It's just a little demo kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But do you just rock master all the time? Or what's your flow there?
Rocking master.
Because it's an example. She said a WordPress site, but it's not, she just means anything other than that's not a web app,
Yeah. Well, for Gallery CSS, that was just me by myself, right? So I just did whatever the hell I did. Like, I probably worked days on end and then checked in, which is terrible, but I probably did it. On any other project, something that I've started doing more recently, and I actually blogged about this too, so I'll find the post, but I use GitHub for everything. And what I actually do when I work with a team now is I create an issue for something that I want to do. Like, say I'm on the site and I'm like, oh, that icon doesn't look quite right. I'll change it, or maybe I'll change the line height on this body of text. I actually do it in the browser, screenshot it, and then drag and drop it into a new GitHub issue, because you can drag in files to the text box in GitHub. I create an issue, and then I actually say to my team, hey guys, what do you think? Does this look better, worse? Do you like my idea? Whatever the feature is, if it's coming out of Illustrator or something like that. And then when I get buy-in, I actually, this is the part that's on my blog, you can actually, there's a command where you can convert an issue, a GitHub issue, into a pull request. And then you can just add in commits. And what's really cool about that is you get like this whole story of, a feature, right? And I think going forward, like say you had like a story about, like your accounts page for something, you could keep coming back and keep adding commits and keep opening and closing that issue as you worked on it. And then you get this whole, history to it. Which, I guess you can branch all of that, right?
You tie an issue to a, this is literally GitHub issues, like their interface for that.
Yeah.
So it's on a feature. You tie an issue to a commit.
Yeah. So it starts off as an issue, and then you do this little command with the hub tool. They have a tool, command line tool called hub, and you can say, convert this issue, like issue number one, into a pull request, and then you can
pull request.
Yeah. You can add commits from a branch, which I think is really, really cool.
But you pull request your own project? Doesn't that mean that you're maintaining your repo, but there's like a canonical repo somewhere? I just don't use pull requests for my own projects,
Yeah, I do. Sometimes you have like a half finished idea and maybe you sketch it out and you take a photo with your phone, or maybe you do it in Illustrator or something and take a quick screenshot. I usually drag it into an issue and then leave it there open and forget about it until, I come back. And if I come back, then I branch it and I work on it.
Hmm. Yeah. That's cool. I was going to say, this happened to me last night working on the accessibility project. I was like, I'm going to change the font on this. And you think like, yeah, that's really cool. So I changed the font, and then I noticed the font sizes were bad. So I was like, I'm going to change the font sizes. And then it just started getting awful. Like I had touched like 20 different files because it's on Bootstrap and stuff like that. And I was just like, oh, this is going downhill. That's when I decided to like, I just command Z'd and got out of everything. And I just like made a branch and repeated my work. Cause I was like, I should have started with a branch. Like, if you're going to do like kind of a drastic kind of change, you can, I always, that's when I start doing branches. So, and maybe a new font could be considered a feature, but you just kind of got to think about how you're thinking about features. Are you making a big change or a little change? Sort of, but I probably should like write an issue. Like I'm changing the font. Here's the screenshot. What do you guys think? You know, and then I have it working in a branch. I haven't affected main or master. So it's kind of isolated that way.
Yeah.
I think you could get client sign off for sure. Like doing stuff like that.
Definitely.
Do you pull requests from a branch to master? I didn't even know that was possible.
Dude, it's easy. GitHub makes it easy. You push your branch up, you publish your branch. Yeah. And then now there's a GUI or like a button that says like make a pull request from that branch you just pushed, huh? And you're like, yes, make a pull request. And then it pull requests. And then it's like,
that makes a lot of sense. That's good.
And then somebody like Dennis or somebody will come through and like push it to master, because in theory, like
you just have to have access to both master and that branch, which you would if it's your own thing. Right, so when I think of pull requests, I think of like in Fitvids or whatever, when somebody has a thing, they have to clone our repo. And I think of a pull request as from somebody's cloned repo to the master repo. But pull requests are clearly more, you know, versatile than that.
Yeah.
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 What do I know?
It's interesting. It's very powerful. Very powerful magic.
Let me do Environments for Humans quick. They have a conference, an online conference, meaning you can attend it from anywhere in the world. Go to cssummit.com. It's their fifth annual one. They've been having the most focused CSS conference for, you know, longer than anybody. It's three tracks, meaning 3 days. Each with, you know, a slightly different focus. So if you, you know, have a particular thing about CSS that you want to focus on, for example, preprocessors is a whole day, right? So if you're like mostly interested in that, you could go on July 25th. That's the last day. It's July 23rd, 24th, and 25th. Tons of people speaking at this thing. It's going to be sweet. So you could get like, you know, Dave, you're doing it. Heck yeah.
Hey-o!
Yeah. nice. Tons of Shop talkers on this list. You know, you could get a couch for your business and buy like the business patch, and you know, and instead of buying flights for everybody, they just sit and watch this. Could be pretty sweet. We've talked about this before. How about how the conversation that happens in the room that you know, because you basically, it's a web, you know, it's, you open up a web window and like the majority of the browser window is the person talking, their slides, and you know, if they choose to show their face and all that type of stuff. And then you go through your slides and watch, but all the rest of the screen is like a chat room. So you're sitting there talking back and forth to them and other attendees there, which is a pretty cool experience. So you can just, it's just easier for people to ask questions. There's more talking than there is at a normal conference. If you want to go to it, again, this is coming up in July, 23rd, 24th, 25th, go to cssummit.com, use coupon code SHOPTALK, which is good for 20% off going to the conference, which is sweet. So thanks for sponsoring, guys, and I'll be tuning in for sure.
Really appreciate it. Ben, you got time for one more?
Yeah, plenty of time. Sure.
Okay. All right. Let's do this question from Mark Pagiao. I'm an up-and-coming web developer out of Rhode Island. I love that. That's a perfect intro for yourself, Mark. I love it. I have been in the industry for about 2 years and up to this point have done both front and back end development, mainly PHP, ASP.NET. My question is, what is the big deal with designing with a grid? What's the deal? I see it all over the place, but have not really been able to find a good reason to use it or description how to use it. Maybe because I tend to have a more developer mindset, but I don't see how I I'm having such a hard time understanding it. You guys got an opinion? Designing with a grid, how to wrap your head around it? Ben, do you use a grid?
I do use a grid.
I mean, in your work for the W3C, you did lots of gridding, huh?
Yeah, I did a little. I did a little stuff there. I use grid for everything, and I think you know, if you're getting some design passed over to you, maybe you work with a designer or something like that. You can, if you start to, you know, consider that there might be a grid there, and you can start to look at the content and look at where things align to and get an idea for where things should sit. You know, I guess if you start looking for it, you'll start seeing it. Like if you're not the designer, right? And then, you know, you can build that in part of your CSS, you know, kind of layout stuff. But actually, Chris has a really good article about this. I'm going to get it wrong, but I believe the title was maybe something like CSS grids don't overthink it. Is that right, Chris?
Oh, yeah. Right. Just kind of, it's just with the idea of that when people Google for grid, as you did in the beginning of your video, you're like, I'm going to look for a carousel, and you find 2 billion carousels. Every day on Twitter, there's a bunch of, somebody has some new grid framework. It's the kind of thing that's, it's getting hard to Google for because there's so many different choices of grids. It gets people thinking of, oh, this is so complicated, I couldn't possibly do it myself. There needs to be some framework to help me. And it just was a rally against that kind of like, you know, you can divide some numbers and float to the left, you know, like this can happen, you know. And, you know, there's even some issues with my grid. I mean, it's so simple that it has little problems. And using a big grid framework, you know, thinks about edge cases and, you know, little math issues and whatever. So I'm not saying against grids. I'm just saying that you can develop a grid yourself. It's not that difficult to do. And especially if you need to, pretty much everything on the web is a grid. If you have a main content area and a sidebar, you have a 2-column grid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every web page is a grid. So you need something, even if you don't even know it. So I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that exactly. I think having a big grid framework is useful. I mean, imagine the New York Times. You know, it's like changes every single day. They need some kind of structure there to help them place this here and this here and this here and know that it's not going to break and know what their choices are and know what they have available to them. And that we haven't even touched on, like, what grid does for, you know, like the psychology of design and you know, making sure it isn't a mess and – I don't know.
That
looks good.
That's one of the biggest benefits. It's kind of like an old Swiss design principle, you know, or maybe Norwegian or something. But it's just the idea that, like, there's like a repetitive consistency in your design. So you're not just like willy-nilly, like, this is 1, 2, 3, 4 picks, and this is 5, 6, 7 picks, you know, like just totally just making up numbers. It's kind of like, okay, I plan to set the content like this, and this is how I want to, if content is floating one way, it should float in exactly this kind of these coordinates here. There's also vertical grids, which are weird, but it's like a vertical rhythm, you know. It's kind of like the way a good kind of maybe way to describe it is it's just like organizing your room, sort of, or maybe like those photos on Instagram where somebody like lays out their closet on the floor and they take a picture of it real nice. You guys know you guys know those?
Oh yeah.
Never seen
like those are very predictable, like, you know where your watch is and stuff like that. However, if it looked like my desk at home, it would just be just a pile of trash, you know, and the pile of trash does not relax people as much as the well laid out, you know, Instagram of your outfit.
Yeah. Now,
hopefully I just targeted my demographic there.
Well, actually, I think a point that you kind of passed over there, like the one thing that's really, really interesting about working with a grid is that once you've kind of defined, you know, how big you want to break things into on your site, maybe you want to do halves, so you have like a left and a right thing, or maybe you want to have thirds or quarters or, you know, fifths or whatever it is, whatever the unit is, you stop thinking about how big the content should be, which really helps when you're doing like an adaptive, like responsive kind of design. You just say, well, you know, on a wide viewport, I want it to be, you know, a third of the screen, and there's going to be two items next to it. And that, you know, I can't remember the last time that I actually typed a pixel value for how big some, like an object was going to be, like an element, right? And same thing in like in design land, like if you're doing that in say Illustrator or something like that, I draw out a grid that I think I'm going to use, or, you know, maybe I like let the content kind of fall into a grid and then work out how big everything should be from there. And then I build the grid out from there. I don't go, okay, well, this thing's 200 pixels wide. I just drag out a box and go, okay, well, that's as wide as the other thing now, you know? So it, it kind of allows you to be a little bit more freeform, even though you've got a lot more constraint.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. For me, it's helped. I always say this, I've said it probably 100 times on the show, but when we started Paravel, like we got on the blueprint grid or whatever. And what that allowed us to do is just said like, oh, we're using this. And when we go back to like work on a site, we know how it works. We don't have to like, how was I sizing, you know, my favorite div, you know, div ID, my favorite div, you know, it's like not these like real, it's like this kind of like framework that you're saying, hey, I'm going to build this way. I mean, if you've done backend, Mark, it's kind of the same reason why you'd use like a backend framework versus like PHP spaghetti code or something like that. It's kind of like, oh, there's kind of some rules here and I just kind of fit into these rules and everything works. And I know I have less bugs. That's my point of view. Mm-hmm.
Good. I hope that was helpful, Mark. I mean, you know, why use grids? I don't know.
It's a big question.
Oh,
yeah.
Indeed.
But I think we all agree. Like, you don't have to use the popular grid framework.css. You can roll your own. But just try to think in like these grid unit kind of mindsets.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, if you use a preprocessor, writing your own grid is super easy. And, you know, I think that is one thing that you should actually, you should suffer from not invented here. Like, you should really, really understand how your objects are being laid out or how your elements are being laid out, right? Using some big magical framework that does that all for you, that seems to me like a bad idea. Because when something goes wrong, you're not going to have any idea how it works. So I think rolling your own for a grid is totally acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yep.
Well, cool. If you want to read more, there's a Coy Vin book all about grids, you know, subtraction.com or whatever. I forget what it's called. It's probably called like grids.
Yeah. He was like the first guy to hardcore make a grid to a website, apply it to a website. Mm-hmm.
So. Which is why I mentioned the New York Times right away, because that was his, you know, that's where he kind of cut his teeth on that, or maybe he cut his teeth far sooner than that, but that's where the grid thing really came to light. So, yeah, it's called Ordering Disorder, Grid Principles for Web Design. I have it. It's good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very codey. It's more the theory of grid, so worth it.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ben.
No problem.
That was awesome. I'm glad the technology is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right across the water. Where do you think? Does it go into space or under the water?
Under the water.
Probably.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
You're all wrong. I have a moon base.
Oh. You on the moon?
Yeah. Oh. Moon basing.
Cool.
I'm just... Moon basing. Ben, how can people follow you on Twitter, give you money? How does that work?
You can follow me at Ben Schwartz on Twitter. So it's Schwartz without a T. That's the only thing. And my website is germanforblack.com.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Everyone check out Gallery CSS. Thank you, Shop Talk Show live listeners, for giving us facts. We really appreciate that in the chat room. And thanks for staying up late or early there if you're listening from Australia. And thank you for downloading the podcast. Be sure to subscribe in iTunes or Instacast or whatever you listen to. Rate us a 5. That's just that easy. And Chris, you got anything else?
ShopTalkShow.com.
We did it.
Hooray.